friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 83 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And Michelle, you're not the only person joining us today. We have a special guest. This is Dr. Jules Lipoff. Dr. Lipoff, thank you so much for joining us. Do you want to start by saying hi and introducing yourself?
Yes. Well, it's a real honor, a privilege to be in this sacred space. Thank you for welcoming me to Dermasphere. I'm Jules Lipoff. I'm a dermatologist in Philadelphia. I've been on faculty at the University of Pennsylvania, and I just heard you go up a notch, Luke, when you went from your normal voice before we started recording to your Dermasphere voice, and I'm blown away.
I've got all kinds of voices. My children are the luckiest children in the world. Also, Grover has made a guest appearance on this podcast a few times. But should I call you Jules, Dr. Lipoff? What do you prefer?
Whatever you all usually do, whatever you're comfortable with.
So you seem very approachable. I will call you Jules. Jules, in some ways, I feel like you seem like a kindred spirit. I hope you don't take that as an insult. But you seem to engage in a lot of creative pursuits. And I feel like I considered myself a creative type before I decided to go into medicine. But I'm still trying to be creative by creating podcasts and things like that. And you've done a lot of this stuff. And I think that's what we'd like to spend some time today talking about and why it's important.
Yeah, I think creativity is essential. It really shouldn't be an add-on or addition to our career. It's actually integral, not just to these creative exploratory things like writing and podcasts or films or what have you. It really should be built into our curricula and how we learn. And I think the way we learn actually predisposes us to things like burnout and imposter syndrome. And when we're using creativity, we stop comparing ourselves to our peers in unhelpful ways and doom scrolling and all that. And we start really looking in intrinsically what we're interested in and how we want to be.
What's doom scrolling? Sorry if I'm too old to know this term.
Oh, that's when you go through Instagram or Facebook or Twitter and you're just listlessly looking for something to charm you, but it just wastes hours and hours and then you have nothing to show for it.
I don't do that. Maybe it's because I engage in these creative pursuits instead. But I think your idea of the way we learn being in problem and creativity potentially being a solution, you're saying that if everybody is kind of learning the same way, we're all reading the textbooks, we're all going to class, we're all taking the same tests, so that encourages us to compare ourselves to how other people do things, rather than if we engage in our own creative pursuits, that's kind of our own individual identity that can't easily be compared to other people, and maybe gives us more of a sense of meaning. Is that fair?
Well, sir, I think it's not uncommon in medicine and in dermatology for perfectionistic types, academically driven, achievement-oriented people to do well, right? And there is, you know, most of us, when we've told someone, oh, I'm a doctor, maybe you've experienced the response, oh, you must be very smart, or, oh, that's so great of you. But in some ways, I mean, maybe we're jaded because we see so many smart people around us, but in some ways, medicine is a very risk-averse career path. You know, you go to college and then medical school and then residency and maybe fellowship, and it's incrementally every year you just move one step up. Very few people fall out of that ladder. As long as you put in the work, maybe it's not easy work, but as long as you put in the work, it's very reassuring, you're going to move forward. But in creative careers like acting or writing or podcasting, you could be busting your ass, keep working and doing all the right things, and you get no further. Right? There's no specific achievement thing that you have to get. A lot of it is luck. It's about struggling. It's about failing. It's about getting rejection, tons of rejection in any creative field to sort of define yourself. And I think it's counterproductive when you feel like you have to just fill that square peg. You're just trying to make it work. You're trying to be the perfect doctor, to know everything, to take every care of every patient perfectly, to know every medicine. Like, you know, obviously it's good to know all that stuff, but it does tend to stop you from thinking independently. It does tend to stop you from being creative and exploring what you want to be.
Yeah. I have heard it said that people tend to succeed until they are average among their peer group. And I feel like I'm fairly average, but this is actually a pretty good group of people to be average around. So I feel like I'm average among, in the University of Utah dermatology faculty or among pediatric dermatologists. I'm actually comfortable being average.
Well, I think, I mean, you seem very well adjusted. And you don't need reassurance. You don't need validation. But I think a lot of people, when they're in these careers, they're like, oh, I need, there's some carrot we're chasing, right? In academia, we're often chasing after certain promotions or certain publications or certain grants or certain status. I think a lot of us, like, there's certain, like, in maybe more of the private world, more like the next home, the next car, the next thing. And when you're chasing after those things, we tend to, once you get them, you're like, okay, what do I do now? Like, it's not inherently fulfilling. And I think it's important to focus us on the struggle and enjoying what we do in the moment, because else you're setting yourself up for failure. And that's why I've been, you know, I had been really involved with creative things since college. I had ran a humor magazine, and then I was writing some articles while in medical school, and then I tried to get involved with writing screenplays and consulting on TV and writing and all sorts and doing podcasts and other things. And this has been fulfilling for me, but for everyone, it can be something different.
Like, so that. Let's say that I am listening to this podcast,
yeah,
and I'm like, yes, Jules, yes, you're right. I am keep pursuing all of these things that don't give me ultimate fulfillment, and I want to do something creative. But how do I kind of shift my current state? Because it's so hard to make changes in my life and find something that I think I will enjoy and do it.
Well, I think a lot of it is, well, I don't know. Are you familiar with the concept of flow? Have you heard that term before? The mental state of flow?
Yes, so, but refresh my memory. I just don't remember and want to see if you do.
So, I happen to have written it down just in case it came up in conversation. But I can't pronounce this, the psychologist who described this, Russian. But he said, quote, the best moments usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. So when you're in it, when you're in flow, it's, you forget that you're doing anything. You, time just passes because you're just so in it. I don't know if, Michelle, when you're reading like DermPath, or Luke, when you're taking care of your wonderful patients, you're just you're in it. You're just doing your thing. And sometimes in my creative pursuits, and even medicine and all this, if it's not even that it has to accomplish anything, it's that you're feeling connected with your work and your purpose. And I think doing things like, one thing that I do is I do this thing called morning pages, where in the morning I try to write freehand for about 30 minutes, just whatever comes to mind, stream of consciousness. Don't hold on to any idea. Don't filter ideas. Don't worry if it's a crappy idea. When I work with students, I say, what project ideas do you have? And they're all nervous about saying the wrong thing. And I tell them, like, there's no such thing as a bad idea, because even crappy ideas can lead to good ideas. If you, let's say Chris Rock, a comedian, he tells 10 jokes and they're amazing. And you think, wow, he's like 100% batting average. How does he do that? Well, he's obviously an experienced, talented comedian, but he probably wrote 100 jokes and then picks out the 10 best and then shows that only those to you, right? So it's kind of coming to terms with failure and rejection as normal and being okay with that. And I think in medicine, we're so afraid of making mistakes. And of course, sometimes mistakes can have consequences for patient care. But within a safe environment, like training and not stigmatizing us when we, you know, try something different, we can really embrace and innovate new ideas and try new things.
I love that. I love also the utilization of the creative space as sort of a safe arena for people to take risks and make mistakes, because, you know, you're right, especially as practicing physicians out of training, our mistakes can have significant consequences, and our risk taking has to be very significantly balanced for clinical benefit versus the risk of whatever treatment that we're doing. But, you know, taking a risk in like a improv class or doing that, you know, in a film project, it's a lot less dangerous, you know, and since we're doing these things for enjoyment and not for a livelihood, I think it brings more of the joy into it.
So it's hard in academic series, for instance. We know that, I know when I write an op-ed or a column in the paper or whatever, that's not going to contribute in any significant way. Maybe reputationally it could be positive, but it's not going to be added to my CV to help me for promotion or anything like that. But it adds fulfillment. It's connecting with people. I write columns for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you know, sometimes it gets on newsletters and email lists and such. But what's most meaningful is that my patients come and say, I read that. It was great. Or they say, hey, I haven't seen a column for a while. What's going on? Or things like that. And they even pitch me ideas sometimes. Here, there's a story that I like. It's in this book called Art and Fear. I don't know if this is apocryphal at all, but it's in this book. It's about a ceramic study that was done in a college class. I don't know if you've heard of this. But they said, we're going to do an experiment. Half of you in the ceramics class are going to be graded based on making a single pot for the entire semester. If you make a perfect pot, you will get an A.
Wow.
And then the other half were said, we don't even care how good it is. We're just going to give you a grade based on the weight of how many pots that you make. So if you get 30 pounds of pots, you get an A, 20 pounds B, so on and so forth. And so then they let the class proceed and make pots as they would during the semester. And at the end, they independently evaluated, blinded, the quality of all the pots. And the highest quality pots came from the group that just had to make a lot of weight of pots. So to me, what I derive from that is not that quantity is better than quality. It's that quantity leads to quality. The people who are fussing about making just their one perfect pot, they didn't learn the process. They didn't learn the mistakes. They were all fussing about, oh, I have to do it just this way. But the people who are saying, oh, I just need to get this done, keep making it, keep working. Oh, that wasn't perfect. Let's move on. You really, you learn and you grow from being willing to make mistakes. In dermatology residency, if you have unknown sessions, for instance, you need to be able to make mistakes in a supportive environment and not feel pimped or embarrassed. You need to be willing to share your thought process out loud, because you could get the right answer for the wrong reason, right? It's the method that matters of how you go about doing things, not the zebra that you happen to guess right. And we tend to reward students when they come up with the rare thing that no one else did, but most that's actually not necessarily being the best practitioner most of the time.
So as an educator, I would love my residents and students to feel like they're in a safe space where it's okay to get things wrong. But I notice many of them, especially the dermatology residents, are terrified of looking dumb or something like that. So what advice do you have to help foster that kind of environment?
Well, I think as a mentor, as a leader, you can demonstrate humility. I think it's very helpful, you know, when you're giving feedback, first of all, you need to recognize that not everyone is prepared to receive that feedback. So first you have to make sure that the feedback is wanted. It's helpful to preface at the beginning of a session, I'm going to be offering feedback at the end if you want it, so that's not a surprise. You need to make sure that it can land as you're criticizing for the sake of criticizing or elevating yourself. So I think it's helpful to also be vulnerable in saying, you know, when I was a resident, I made this kind of mistake, or I struggled with this, to lead in like that. And there's even studies to suggest that I think something like for every, to make it feel like balanced positive and negative feedback, you need five times as much positive as negative. That's because we're just going to focus on the negative. We're perfectionistic too. So I think being humble, vulnerable, and empathetic, that helps a lot. And then as a learner, I think you really need to have the perspective, you know, if I get this right, yay for me. But if I get this wrong, I've identified something I don't know. And that is actually an incredible achievement. I'm really directing what I need to focus on, what I want to learn, and that's going to really help me. And so it's win-win. Like, there's no way to lose here. Either I get something right or I figure out what I got to learn. And you really have to have that attitude. Like, professional athletes, people who are operating at high levels, they make mistakes, they struggle, but they don't let that get them down. They use that as motivation to just target how they're going to practice moving forward.
Hooray, I figured out how to get better.
Something like that. I mean, hey, we all have egos. Like, we're like, oh man, I just blew my chance of impressing Luke by knowing all that cool stuff. And now he's always going to think I'm an idiot. I mean, we all have those voices in our heads. I'm not saying that we don't, but it just to let that pass and just really like be logical and thoughtful about how you learn.
So spoilers to anyone rotating with me, if you're going to join my clinic, brush up on your amides versus esters when it comes to injected anesthetics and tell me what epinephrine does while we mix it with lidocaine. Well, Jules, thanks so much for joining us today. I don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you have a lot of creative pursuits that you have done. Where can people find out more about them, more about you, stuff like that?
Yeah, well, I love talking about the stuff. I think it's important. I have a website, which is just my name, Jules Lipoff, J-U-L-E-S, L-I-P as in Peter, O-F, F as in Frank, .com. And I have all of my academic work. I have all of my lay press work. And, I have even some links to things like a humorous list I had published in McSweeney's back in the day. And yeah, we didn't get to it, but I had interned for The Onion and Mad Magazine in college. And I've consulted for the resident television medical drama on Fox. Like, this stuff is really fun. And I think when you're exploring all of your interests and just going for it, it makes your life more satisfying, your career more satisfying, and you're probably a lot more interesting and fun to be around.
And you reduce burnout, which is the hot topic these days too.
Yeah, exactly. You stop saying, oh, why do I need to be like that person? You're like, I'm just trying to be me. And you're not, even if you're sometimes working really hard, you're enjoying it. It's more meaningful. It's if you are setting your agenda, if it's a voluntary agenda that you've set, you don't necessarily mind working hard because you're your own boss in that way.
And extra kudos to institutions and academic departments like the one here at the University of Utah for encouraging and supporting its faculty to do crazy things like have a dermatology podcast.
And it can be career directed, like podcast. It can also be, it can be more acrobatic work, dance, art, acting, as someone I know might be pursuing. it's these things. I mean, we're so goal directed. I have this problem, like, oh, everything I have to do has to be towards some goal. Like, oh, I'm going to watch a Netflix show. I can take notes how that could inform me writing something. No, I can just enjoy it. Sometimes just doing, even if you're not good at it, like if I am going to play basketball, I'm not going to be the best at basketball, but just doing something that's going to give you fulfillment and enjoyment, a hobby, even, it can be really valuable.
Absolutely. One of my favorite quotes is, in order to get to be good at something, you first have to be willing to be really bad at it. And it's also absolutely fine to enjoy something just for the sake of doing it.
Definitely.
Well, we'll have to have you back here, Jules. It seems like you've got a lot that we can talk about. Really appreciate you being on here today, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
Definitely. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jules.
And now for something completely different. Always my favorite type of segue. The old Monty Python approach. So for the rest of this episode, I want to talk about pediatric longitudinal melanonychia. Because I've recently had a patient where this has been quite a conundrum for me. So this is a little 2-year-old girl. Let's call her Heather. It's not really her name. And she came to see me when she was 14 months old, and she had longitudinal melanonychia of one of her fingernails. And it was kind of big. It was about 60% of the nail plate. But it had been there since she was born and was slowly growing, and so I wasn't worried about it. And I said, it's probably a congenital melanocytic nevus. We can just kind of keep an eye on it. And then she came to see me again about a month ago, and she's now 2 years old. And now it's expanded significantly and occupies 90 to 95% of her nail plate, probably. And I think if you hallucinate, you can see a little bit of pigment perhaps on some of the surrounding nail folds. Perhaps we could consider that Hutchinson sign. And I again said, well, I think this is basically a congenital melanocytic nevus doing what congenital melanocytic nevi do. So I don't really think we need to do anything. But it is kind of dramatic in appearance, so maybe I should just ask a couple of my colleagues to make sure that everybody agrees we don't need to biopsy it. And then I asked people, and many people said, I think we should biopsy that thing. And so I ended up talking to like 10 different specialists, pigmented lesion experts, hand surgeons, dermoscopy experts, and got a lot of different opinions about what we should do. So thank you to any of my colleagues who happen to be listening. I really appreciate you weighing in on this case. And I wish there were a clear answer, but I guess my takeaway is that there probably isn't one. And to reinforce the fact that there's not a clear answer, we're going to spend the rest of this episode talking about why there is not a clear answer about what to do in cases like this one. And Michelle, you've got the first article about this thorny issue to talk about.
Thorny. Difficult with nails, complicated. I haven't seen a picture of that lesion, have I? Have I at all?
You have not, but I'm happy to send it to you if you would like.
I would like to look at it. So I'm going to talk about the clinical pathologic features of nail metrix nevi in Asians, which is one of the largest studies to date on this particular topic. And this is a great pleasure to do because I'm pretty sure that one of my good friends is one of the authors for this paper. So this is out of the JAD.
Wait, pretty sure they're your good friend, or you're pretty sure they're one of the authors?
I'm pretty sure that this is the person that I think it is. So their name is the same, and the place where they worked is correct for my perception. I wasn't able to independently confirm yet that that is indeed my good friend, Anji Kwan, but I believe that it is. So this is an article from the JAD, and this is to discuss the clinical pathologic features of 28 cases of nail metrix nevi in Asians comparing children and adults. The chief authors are Jae Ho Lee and Don Yun Lee, and then Anji Kwan is a friend of mine who's also an author here. This paper is out of the Republic of Korea in Seoul and Port Chester, New York, which is where my friend becomes involved. She's not currently living in Korea, per my knowledge. So, background, as we were just discussing, the clinical distinction between nail metrix nevi and subungual melanoma can be challenging. The clinical dermoscopic features need to be delineated more precisely to help guide our clinical management of these lesions. So they wanted to analyze the clinical pathologic features of childhood and adult nail matrix nevi and propose a clinical dermoscopic feature kind of suite that could help differentiate nail matrix nevi from subungual melanomas. They reviewed the clinical dermoscopic and histologic findings of patients from a single tertiary referral center from 2012 to 2015. In all, they had 20 children and 8 adults with nail matrix nevi. In the results, except for 2 cases of total melaninichia, which does occur more frequently in children and with congenital lesions, the affected nails demonstrated longitudinal melaninichia with sharply demarcated bands that were clearly distinguished from the surrounding nail plate, which becomes important. The melaninichia was wider amongst children than amongst adults, and I don't think that's a surprise for anybody who's dealt with melanocytic lesions in children. They do not follow the rules that we assign to melanocytic lesions in adults. They tend to be larger, they tend to be more unique looking, they tend to involve more adnexal structures, so you end up with more hypertrophies in the picture, so they can just look a little bit more atypical. Nail dystrophy was more frequent in wider lesions, and the authors go in to surmise why this might be, so we'll discuss that later. Hutchinson sign was observed in pediatric cases at the hyponychium, the skin underneath the front part of the nail, and or the proximal nail fold cuticles. And all hyponychial pigmentation demonstrated this longitudinal brushy pigmentation under dermoscopy. And this has been described for a little while in congenital lesions. And I really do like this because once you've seen a picture of this longitudinal brushy pigmentation, it's a very nice little Kodachrome that sits in your brain and helps you distinguish it from the parallel ridge and parallel furrow patterns we're accustomed to looking for on acral skin. I do want to say, outside of this article, when it comes to tissue around a large melanoma on acral skin and large acral melanomas in general, they may have areas that show benign pigment patterns, like either the parallel furrow pattern or the fibrillar pattern or lattice patterns. in part of the lesion, but other parts of the lesion will be also atypical and the lesion will be large and multi-component. So finding a single area or areas of benign pattern in a large melanocytic neoplasm on the foot, but in the face of other atypical findings, doesn't discount the atypia of that lesion. So that's just a general plug to put out there.
But so that longitudinal... Sorry, these are 28 cases that were all biopsy-proven melanocytic nevi of the nail unit. And I wonder if this brush sign or longitudinal brushy pattern, as they call it, might be one of the most important things to come out of this article.
I think it
Again,
is.
Again, that's the hyponychium, which is probably a bellworthy term,
oh, yes,
right?
Yes.
So that's the distal part of the skin right underneath the free edge of the nail plate. And they saw this brush pattern on the congenital melanocytic nevi, which my patient had, you know, when looking at it under dermoscopy, which is one reason why at least some people said we should monitor it.
Send me a picture. Okay. So the study here was a retrospective study of Asian patients at a single center. So those are its limitations. And this is the largest case to series to date of biopsy-confirmed nail nail matrix nevi. It highlights the important clinico-dermoscopic features between pediatric and adult nail matrix nevi, and they propose that cases of longitudinal melaninichia with a sharply demarcated pigment band of even width, patients that have Hutchinson sign with longitudinal brushy pigmentation, these are features that would favor a diagnosis of nail matrix nevus over subungual melanoma. So as you just highlighted very nicely, Luke, thank you so much for the wonderful introduction. Nail matrix nevi are going to present a diagnostic challenge for a lot of people. Their clinical features can overlap with those of subungual melanoma, especially in children, including things such as the Hutchinson sign, nail plate deformity, and irregular pigmentation pattern. So matrix biopsy may be necessary to resolve the differential diagnosis, but as we know, that can also potentially cause dystrophy of the nail plate that can be lifelong. So they want to analyze the clinical dermoscopic and histopathologic features of adult and childhood nail matrix nevi to compare these findings with the previously published clinical dermoscopic and histologic findings that have been defined for subungual melanoma. Now, they don't have very many adults represented in this study, 20 children and 8 adult patients. I think that sometimes when they can't find a difference between pediatric and adult nail unit melanoma, it may have to do with the fact that they don't have very many adults to create more of a signal. But that's just my kind of surmise coming off of reading this. So as we know, children can have lesions that have dermoscopically unusual melanocytic lesions all over their body. You know, they can have Spitz nevi that don't follow any rules. They can have congenital melanocytic nevi of other parts of the body that don't follow typical rules. Compared with nail matrix nevi in adults, the pediatric nail matrix nevi can be wider. We've spoken about bandwidth with longitudinal melaninichia in previous episodes of Dermosphere and its importance in predicting the potential malignancy of the nail unit melanocytic lesion. Those rules don't really seem to apply to children. We'll talk about why. In pediatric cases of even width, sharply demarcated longitudinal melaninichia with Hutchinson sign with that longitudinal brushy pigment may favor this diagnosis of a benign nevus. So getting into kind of the nitty-gritty here, they looked at 17 patients' dermoscopic exams because they had the images for those 17 patients that had been imaged with a portable digital dermoscopic device, which was a Dermalite 2. Nail plate hyponychium and nail fold were documented. And if you've never tried to take a picture of a nail unit through a dermatoscope, that's not always easy. It doesn't always fit in one unit, one photograph. So you may have to take multiple photographs to ensure that you have in-focus pictures of all of those components of the nail. And in their assessment of this, they classified dermoscopic patterns according to previous literature, which includes, of course, the longitudinal melaninichia. They wanted to look at the color of the band, the presence of globules, the pattern of the band. Irregular band patterns were categorized into 3 subtypes, variegated color or color variegation, inconsistent with bandwidth, which is something you can see in a lesion that's changing dynamically, right? Because the nail itself is just analogous to the stratum corneum on top of a nevus. So just as that can be hyperpigmented in times of irritation with the nevus, let's say if you've seen any of your patients this summer who've gone out and gotten too much sun and then all of their dysplastic nevi have this black lamella on top of them, which histopathologically is actually pigmented perikeratosis, that's a reactive change usually that you can see in patients. Of course, if you saw it, of course, only in a single lesion, it might raise an eyebrow or two, but If one can raise an eyebrow, us being dermatologists and sometimes taking advantage of our own Botox. So we looked at those three characteristics: color variegation, inconsistent bandwidth, and then loss of parallelism. Loss of parallelism, if you kind of think about sort of shooting, let's say, flashlights straight in front of you. If somebody starts to turn their little flashlight in, you're going to cross the like light bands, or if you're a big Ghostbusters fan and a giant nerd like Luke and I are, you'd be like, don't cross the streams for the Ghostbusters.
Yep, first thing that came to mind.
Me too, 100%. I was like, how would a normal person think about it? Forget about it. We're talking about Ghostbusters. So if you cross the streams, chaos ensues. So loss of parallelism is something that we talk about in adult ungual melanoma as a potential concerning feature, potentially signifying some kind of architectural disarray. So loss of parallelism can also involve abrupt termination or fusion of the lines as well. Melaninichia under the three patterns were considered, under melaninichia that didn't have one of those three things, color variegation, inconsistent bandwidth, or loss of parallelism, were considered regular. The hyponychium and nail folds, including the cuticle, were examined for presence of Hutchinson sign and its pigmentation pattern. They had biopsies performed on 27 patients. 3 millimeter punch biopsies were taken from the nail matrix under the proximal nail fold at the darkest point of nail pigmentation.
So I think that part's kind of nice too. So if you have a patient and you're just looking for some kind of direction about what kind of biopsy to perform, you know, these guys are experts and this is what they did.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with that. A lot of people also advocate for and use in procedure post nail avulsion dermoscopy to further assess the lesion. If you're going to do that, an ice cap, which is like the little clear plastic top that can go onto your dermatoscope and is a disposable piece of medical technology, can be used to take good photographs without contaminating your dermatoscope with blood. In a pinch, you can also use a glass slide that can also become an interface between you and potentially a bloody field.
So you're the dermatopathologist, Michelle. Mm-hmm. These guys didn't comment on it, but is a 3 millimeter punch enough tissue? And I know what your favorite wine is.
Yes, the favorite wine of the dermatopathologist is more tissue, please. So we always do like to have as much tissue to interpret as possible. A 3 millimeter punch out of a lesion larger than that means you're going to be interpreting this melanocytic lesion without context, which does make it more difficult to do. Of course, we're trying to balance here the risk of permanent nail deformity with the need for sufficient tissue. I think that this is a heavily utilized approach that a lot of people will partake in. Other people will do sort of a fusiform excision or incisional biopsy of the lesion if that's possible. And there's different schools of thought around that. I think small biopsies are usually the rule with nail matrix lesions, just because you're dealing with something that might cause permanent deformity in a patient. And especially here, we're talking about children. So we want to think about those things. One thing I do want to emphasize as a dermatopathologist, so they removed the nail plate, right? You would want to submit any involved nail plate, because sometimes when you take the nail plate off, you rip part of the nail bed epithelium with it, which is why it's not a nice thing to do to people without numbing their skin first. So a lot of the nail bed epithelium ends up adherent to the underside of the nail plate. So I would say that submitting the nail plate and the biopsy from underneath, potentially in two different cassettes, would make sure that you have all the tissue you need to assess. Don't throw the nail plate out. It can sometimes be involved in the tissue.
And don't tape it back on like a biologic dressing then. It sounds like it's got some important diagnostic value.
And you could do, like, some people will do like a burr hole kind of like through the nail plate with a punch.
Like an Aaron Burr hole. Like he shot the gun right there and knocked a hole in the nail.
Yes, exactly, right? So some people will like use that and then submit just the overlying nail plate. Regardless, if it's possible, just thinking about that's reasonable.
Sounds like an interesting procedure. I'd like to be in the room where it happens.
All of these are jokes related to Hamilton, right?
Well, that one was. I'm pretty sure he was an actual historic person, too.
I'm sure he was. I mean, it's historically accurate from my perception. Hopefully not all of it, but maybe some of it. Okay. So, anywho, they did the hyponychial biopsy as well in two patients. So, two patients that had hyponychial pigmentation or Hutchinson sign in this case series with that longitudinal brushy pigmentation did have biopsies. The diagnosis of nail matrix nevus was made if they had melanocytic nests predominating, only some melanocytes showing nuclear atypia. They excluded subungual melanoma by comparing the histopathologic findings with those of subungual melanoma in situ. The following features were included as variables. So they looked at melanocytic nests, retraction artifact around the melanocytic nests, pigment incontinence, melanocytic dendrites, nuclear hyperchromatism, nuclear enlargements, transepithelial elimination or pagetoid spread of melanocytes. And they kind of compared these across the different patients. Nuclear enlargement was designated as small, medium, and large. And as one is taught to do in histopathology, you're comparing the size of the melanocyte's nucleus to the size of the nuclei of its neighboring skin cells. So if it's neighboring keratinocytes, or here they call them neighboring epithelial cells, so NDNEC, which I thought was cute. Small was a diameter of less than or equal to the neighboring keratinocyte. Medium diameter of equal to 1 to 2 times that of the neighboring keratinocyte, and large is going to be greater than 2 times that of the neighboring keratinocyte. Nuclear size can be heterogeneous, so they recorded all types of size in each lesion. Pagetoid spread was defined as melanocytes being present above the germinative cell layer, and transepithelial elimination indicates that there are melanocytes within the nail plate. So they looked at these cases, 28 nail matrix nevi, 16 of the patients were female, 12 were male. The average age was 5.5 years in the pediatric patients. They had recorded the width of the melaninichia as a percentage of the nail it involved, the color of the melaninichia, the presence or absence of nail dystrophy, and the presence or absence of Hutchinson's sign.
So nail dystrophy also sounds scary, right?
It does sound scary.
But again, these are all biopsy-proven nevi.
And
they've got some really cool pictures here. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure we have time to talk about the other couple articles we've got today, Michelle. So I was thinking that the most important thing that came out of this may be the brushy pattern thing potentially being reassuring, though, again, they didn't have melanoma to compare it to. But they state in the discussion that this sort of brushy pattern is different than the pattern in the hyponychium of a subungual melanoma, which might be a little bit more haphazard, which we generally expect with malignancies. And then you also mentioned they had something else to say about why nail dystrophy can occur in these benign cases.
Mm-hmm. So the high points of the rest of this article are fingernails were affected more than toenails. Thumbnail was the most commonly affected. And we see that in other publications, the thumbnail or the great toe tend to be more involved. That's also the case with nail unit melanoma, unfortunately. Average melaninichia width was larger in children, so it was 3.5 times greater in children than in adults, and total melaninichia, where the entire nail itself is pigmented, was seen only in pediatric cases. The 16 cases of wide melaninichia, more than 20% of the nail blade, tended to occur more frequently with nail dystrophy. So the dystrophy of the nail, they surmise, might have to do with the interference of the keratin, actually. So the nail plate development having that incorporated melanin pigment into the sulfur and keratin protein of the nail plate, they surmise kind of softens the plate, and that predisposes it to dystrophic changes. So
kind
wide melanin.
Interesting. Like I would be scared with a dystrophic nail and a pigment change. But
and that
it
was
turns
more
out it can just happen.
Absolutely. And it was more common when the nail had greater involvement, when there was more percentage of the nail involved. After biopsy, there was a change in bandwidth in 17 cases, 15 of which were thought to be biopsy related, and nail deformity, which is important, occurred in 42.9% of cases. They also had color change and the presence of triangle sign emerging after the biopsy in one case. So the most important things that came out of this were that pediatric patients can involve a lot of the nail plate. They can have irregular banding. Actually, 7 of their patients had irregular banding with color variegation, inconsistent bands, or loss of parallelism. Hutchinson sign was present in 30% of these nail matrix nevi that tended to have that longitudinal brushy pigmentation. The wider band, like we said, is going to be more likely to cause the dystrophy. There was one thing where we almost buried the lead a little bit, in that 23 of these 28 cases had upward ascent of nests or single melanocytes, and transepithelial elimination of melanocytes were seen in 17 cases. This is, you know, typically categorized as like pagetoid scatter and something that would usually raise a lot of concern. But when you're looking at lesions in a pediatric patient in a special site, you have to use special criteria to evaluate that. So that's an important point that I think can't be overemphasized. A snapshot of just that kind of histology without context, most people would knee-jerk to, oh, that's going to be malignant. But this is a feature that was frequently observed in benign lesions. A very important part was that clear demarcation from the adjacent uninvolved nail plate that didn't have the pigment. So in the nail matrix nevi, there was a crisp and sharp delineation of the banding of the longitudinal melaninicia from the normal nail. In subungual melanoma, it tends to blur diffusely, like the daytime TV filter or a Snapchat filter for the young people out there who've never seen a soap opera. So that is, I think, an important point to bring forward. They did have one patient that had a case that of longitudinal melaninicia that widened. A lot of the support for longitudinal monitoring comes from this article and the subsequent article. This one patient was first observed to have the lesion at 4 months of age. The lesion was biopsied at 22 months. Of course, it grew. The patient was a very small baby when it was first diagnosed. About more than 40% of the patients having dystrophy following the biopsy, I think, is an important point. And then the globules being present in nail matrix nevi is another important point, because we talk about this a lot in nail matrix melanoma, but globules tend to relate to either very quick growth of the lesion or suprabasal nests of melanocytes. And they're analogous to the pigmented dots that are seen in dermoscopy in other parts of the body, where you're seeing actually pagetoid nests or single melanocytes sometimes with those dots. The difference, of course, being in this nail matrix nevi of children, this is an acceptable finding. So I think that all of those are very important things to kind of combine in your assessment of this. They go into the detail a little bit about the histopathology, which is a very interesting thing for a histopathologist, but I'll probably just say a few things about that. One of them being clefting around individual nests was acceptable. Clefting around individual melanocytes was less favorable. That kind of is analogous to how we interpret things like Spitz nevi in children. And I think that the most important points I think that come out from this article are that significant involvement of the nail plate, broad involvement, high percentage of the nail plate involved, or even total melaninicia is acceptable in children. And then, of course, that nice linear brushy pigmentation.
So, you know, the upshot is that it's really hard, and maybe there just isn't a good answer. And that's basically what the other articles say as well. So maybe I'll talk about this one in a little bit less detail. But the one that you just mentioned was the largest analysis to date of this stuff. But that was in 2018. So here in 2020, we've got 35 cases, which is out of the journal Histopathology. And the title is Clinicopathological Diversity and Outcome of Longitudinal Melaninicia in Children and Adolescents. Analysis of 35 cases identified by excision specimens. The authors are out of China and include Jing Ren and Jincheng Kong. So you mentioned that we had talked about this stuff in a couple other episodes. So way back in demo episode number 3, we talked about some of the signs that were more associated with melanoma of the nail unit, but in adults mostly. So that was a series of 84 patients aged 14 to 81. They had a few cases of subungual melanoma, 8 of them. And one of those cases was an 18-year-old. So whether or not you consider that pediatric, you know, I guess it's up to you. And one of the things they found was a band of melaninicia encompassing 40% or more of the nail plate was associated with a higher risk of melanoma. Though, as you just mentioned, the kids get to break the rules, just like they do in real life. They're breaking all the rules right now. But back in episode 80, really recently, we discussed that nail unit nevi in kids, especially congenital nevi, can break these rules and have a lot of these features that look scary, including Hutchinson sign and nail dystrophy and complete melaninicia. So what do you do? Which was the conundrum I was in with my patient Heather. So this particular article is a series of 35 patients, age 1 to 20, with longitudinal melaninicia who underwent biopsy or excision, and none of them were melanoma. Some of them look pretty scary, even scarier than my patient's nail, and displayed a lot of these features that you might associate with melanoma. 40% of them had a Hutchinson sign. 2/3 of them had a band of 3 millimeters or greater. And remember, these are little kids, so their nails are probably smaller. So 3 millimeters is bigger for them than for us. Some of them, 29%, had complete melaninicia. The whole nail was dark. 14% of them had nail deformity. And 1 or 2 even had a subungual nodule. That seems scary. And then they also had some concerning features histologically, and this will make sense to you, I presume, such as a predominance of single units of melanocytes, high cell density, nuclear atypia, pagetoid spread, and multinucleated giant cells. Some of those concerning histologic features were associated more with children over age 10, by the way, in case that matters. So there, out of these 35 patients, 32 of them had follow-up of some kind, and that follow-up ranged from 3 months to 6.5 years. 84% of them had nail deformity after biopsy or excision, so much higher than your case, Michelle, but maybe I feel like they were quite conservative in terms of their biopsies in the case series you discussed, 3mm punches. I think these guys had a variety of different excision and slash biopsy approaches. So 84% of them nail deformity, and 13% of these people had recurrence of some kind. But only 13, that's not too much. So with these findings, the authors advocate for a conservative approach for most pediatric longitudinal melanonychia and suggest that partial biopsy be reserved for lesions showing, quote, rapid growth. Though, of course, what exactly is rapid growth?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, this is way too granular for science to answer right now. We don't have enough data. So we just have to use our clinical judgment, I guess. But it's frustrating when the clinical judgment from case series like these says that it's probably fine. But then Heather's sitting there looking cutely at you with her little dark fingernail. And you're wondering what you would do if it was your daughter, for example.
Yes.
Also, how do any of these doctors know that these lesions weren't really melanoma, especially those that had atypical histology?
Mm-hmm.
Well, can anybody really know for sure? So we've talked about the gold standard problem, I think, once or twice. Like, I suppose, how do you know something is really melanoma? A lot of pathologists don't agree with each other when it comes to diagnosing some of these tough cases, even when it's not the nail. And studies have shown that some pathologists don't even agree with themselves. If you show the same pathologist the same lesion 6 months apart, they might come up with different diagnoses, from what I've heard, as when they're, you know, especially challenging. And so there's this gold standard problem. I suppose death from metastatic disease is the only way you can really tell if something was a melanoma.
Mm-hmm.
Metastases that don't lead to organ damage, you know, sometimes we see that in like Spitz nevi, where they can occasionally be found in lymph nodes and stuff. Mm-hmm. So even just metastases don't necessarily tell you. I think you can sense my frustration here.
Oh, yeah. Well, and complicating that also is the fact that benign nevi, congenital nevi, and definitely Spitz nevi can go colonize a lymph node as a capsular nevus. And some pathologists, especially if your lymph nodes are being read by a general pathologist who's not familiar with this fact, may call that a positive lymph node, even though it's just a normal phenomenon that we know happens with benign lesions. So even the positivity of lymph nodes after excision of something suspected to be a melanoma without expert review may be controversial.
Well, at least we know that in these cases, none of those lesions behaved like melanoma during their follow-up period, which was 3 months to 6.5 years. And perhaps immunohistochemistry can come to the rescue. When we were looking into this, one of the residents who experienced some of my angst about Heather's case was looking into some of these articles and found one case report that said, you know, staining with P16 could be potentially helpful. One of our dermatopathologists said PRAME in Heather's case might be helpful. And I think a lot of the cases we're talking about, even though they're pretty recent, might not be as recent as PRAME. So maybe that can really help. But I don't know if there's been any case reports of PRAME helping out in a longitudinal melanonychia case in a pediatric patient. So I hope that those sorts of tools and, you know, other fancy genetic techniques can help sort it out.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we can get a little better understanding of this. And, you know, this is an area where I see great utility in the potential of a specifically devised gene expression profile test that's calibrated to look for pediatric patients of the nail unit. I think that that's a special tissue and a special patient population, and you have to be thoughtful about it.
But then we have to have enough specimens.
Exactly.
So after reading all of this, I started wondering, has subungual melanoma ever been reported in a child, you know, presenting as longitudinal melanonychia? How about a child under age 10? Because remember, in this particular case series, some of those abnormal histologic features were associated in kids over age 10.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got a case series of them.
We do. So this is nice. So this is a article out of Actis Dermosilographias. Dermosilographicas. So as you may perceive from my expert level pronunciation, I'm kidding, of course. This is an article that was originally actually written in Spanish and then was translated into English. Here it's presented in English as a translated article, submungual melanocytic lesions in pediatric patients. Authors are E. Rios Vinuela, I think, and then C. Requena, or Requena, I can't tell, there's no tilde over the N. And there's another author with the same last name, which may be, I don't know, sibling or spouse, potentially, or just a coincidence that happens too. If I run into another Tarbox, I'm pretty sure we're related somehow, but I'm not always positive. This is published out of Valencia, Spain, and Madrid, Spain in 2021, and published in March of 2022. So this goes over the 21 cases that have been described in the literature to date of pediatric subungual melanocytic lesions. And the kind of take-home point from this is that pediatric nail unit melanoma is exquisitely rare. Even the 21 cases that we believe exist from the literature are somewhat controversial because some of them are quite old. The imaging for some of them is somewhat incomplete, and a bad outcome is fortunately quite rare in this patient population.
And I think importantly, almost all of them have been diagnosed as melanoma in situ rather than invasive melanoma. And so you could say, well, we've got all these case theories from the past 5 years that say that these lesions can have all kinds of atypical histologic findings. But, you know, nowadays we don't think that they're melanoma in situ. Maybe back in the 70s or 80s or 90s, they would call these things melanoma in situ. So, arg!
So I'm going to try to sum up the rest of this article in 8 points or less, because we've gone over a lot of the things that are already covered. It is a very high quality article, and I very much enjoyed reading it. So, next important points. In an adult, a de novo longitudinal melaninicia affecting a single finger in an adult, that is a very concerning clinical scenario for the possibility of subungual melanoma in an adult. So these characteristics are sudden onset, presence of a wide band more than 5 millimeters or total melaninicia, rapid darkening or widening of the band, appearance of heterogeneous bands of different colors, and bands with poorly defined borders. Remember, we talked about that last time, sharp circumscription from the normal adjacent nail plate versus this poorly defined border that you can see in subungual melanoma. Triangular melaninicia, which means it's wider at the proximal than the distal end, which means that it's growing over time. Nail dystrophy, pigmentation of the eponychium or hyponychium, which we call Hutchinson sign, and involvement of the thumb, index finger, or great toe. Remember I was saying earlier, those digits also are more common for melanocytic nevi, so that's not super helpful. But those are all the worrisome things in an adult. These are not valid for longitudinal melaninicia in children. So in this period of study here, they looked over the most frequent causes of longitudinal melaninicia writ large for children. About 75% of cases of longitudinal melaninicia in a child is going to be a melanocytic nevus. So 75% of the time, if you have longitudinal melaninicia in a child, it's a nail unit nevus. In an adult, 73% of patients with this longitudinal melaninicia are due to melanocytic hyperactivation. So this is going to be a nail unit lentigo or medication potentially activating nail unit melanocytes to make that kind of more gray-brown light color that we associate with melanocytic hyperactivation versus proliferation. So that is kind of another interesting point. Of course, we know that congenital lesions can behave uniquely. They talk about the fact that we're going to stain these if we need to stain them with things that would show up in a melanocyte that's not necessarily active. So there are certain immunohistochemical stains that are going to be more positive in a melanocytic lesion where there's a lot of activity, a lot of a lack of quiescence, if you will. And so HMB45 we sometimes will use on non-nail unit skin to look at the activation of melanocytes. That's not a stain that would typically be useful in a nail unit because most of the melanocytes are quiescent. So you might use SRY box transcription factor 10. Do you deduce what the name for that stain is, Luke, that we use, that SRY box transcription factor 10?
SOX10.
Don't forget, those of you in training, that alternate names are fair game for testing circumstances, especially if it's not an eponym. So you might want to know all of the ways these things can be described. And then, of course, you might also use microphthalmia-associated transcription factor or MITF to help stain these things. Subungual melanocytes can be present in the suprabasal layers. That's not an abnormal finding. It has to do with the way that the tissue and the integrins on the melanocytes kind of interact with each other. So suprabasally located melanocytes in the nail unit are not malignant. And that's actually another good test question that I've seen, where they put a picture of nail unit histology with an immunostain highlighting melanocytes showing happy single dendritic melanocytes above the basal layer, and then asking, is this normal or is this melanoma? In a nail unit, that's just something that can happen. So that's something you should know. The suprabasal sort of origination of or orientation of the melanocytes in a nail unit is acceptable. And then finally, you really just need to interpret the clinical context, the patient's age, the findings dermoscopically to help come together with a cohesive diagnosis. But even in the face of all of that, with expert level dermatopathologists, agreement is not perfect. So this is a very unique class of neoplasms. And then they kind of go through the different cases of melanoma that have been reported in the literature. They talk about the limitations in fact that we don't have complete histology on many of these cases. Some of the images are challenging to interpret because they're from the 60s and 70s. Some of them might be low quality or incomplete images. And many of them, of course, would be in black and white because they would be older publications. So even in the 21 cases presented in the literature of pediatric subungual melanoma, significantly bad outcomes are rare. And fortunately, that seems to be the case in the population writ large. So I thought that that was very well presented, a very interesting article.
So here we've got two different case series, which show over 50 cases of not too scary looking to really quite scary looking longitudinal melanonychia that were biopsied and shown to not be melanoma. And there have been 21 cases in the literature reported of subungual melanoma in pediatric cases. But a lot of those, again, are controversial, and many occurred in older children. The most convincing case they report in this analysis was a 13-year-old. Sort of that one did really look like an invasive melanoma, that it was a lymph node. Maybe it was some kind of atypical Spitz tumor and it never would have done anything. You know, again, limits of current science. But 13-year-old patient, much different than Heather, who's two and has had this thing since birth.
Yeah,
so, you know, listeners, think to yourself what you would do. I guess this is why they say there's the art of medicine sometimes. So this seems to be the current state of knowledge, unless there's some kind of article that we missed that sort of puts all this to rest, which would be wonderful. So if you know of such an article, please let me know. Otherwise, this is where we're at. And I think, you know, what a lot of my colleagues said really kind of sums all this up, that the literature says that the odds of this lesion in Heather's finger being melanoma are really, really small. It is definitely most likely benign. But how comfortable are you not knowing for sure? And even though it does cause deformity, you know, it's a deformity of a single nail and a single finger. It's not like it's some huge disfiguring procedure, and then we can not have to worry about it anymore. And we all expect it to look like it's a nevus under the microscope. And then we can say, all right, now we know for sure. Sorry about your nail, but, you know, family doesn't have to worry about it anymore for the rest of her life and stuff like that. And what would you want to do if this were your daughter? So this is the discussion I had with Heather's mom. I said, well, you know, I talked to a lot of people. I read a lot of articles, and it's really likely that this is just a mole, but we can't know for sure unless we go ahead and biopsy it or remove it. And she said that she'd think about it and discuss with her husband and let me know. So that's where we're at, and I guess that's kind of the best we can do.
And one other article that I looked at kind of reading about this talked about a different set of ABCDs for nail unit melanonychia. So we know that we have our typical ABCDs in dermatology with our, you know, I'm not going to go over them. Everyone knows them. For normal melanocytic lesions, there's a specific set also for pediatric ones. Luke, do you want to do the pediatric ABCDs?
I do not.
Okay. So with pediatric ones, usually the A is actually for like amelanotic, because they are more likely to have an amelanotic lesion than an adult person. B, I think, is bleeding bump. So that means that it's kind of a lesion that maybe has grown so fast that it can't maintain epidermal integrity. Color uniformity. So melanomas in children are actually often only one color, possibly because they grow so quickly. And then their D is de novo or NA diameter. So that's sort of the ABCDs for pediatric melanoma. They proposed another one for longitudinal melanonychia. The A in that one is age. So age, older age, like fifth to seventh decades for age for risk for longitudinal melanonychia. B for nail band, brown to black in color, more than 3 millimeters wide with irregular borders. C still is change in the size of the band, change in morphology. D is for digit involved, so thumb greater than the hallux, greater than the index finger on the dominant hand. And then a single digit is also worrisome. So single digit worrisome, thumb most worrisome, great toe second most, index finger third most. E in this longitudinal melanonychia arrangement is extension, meaning Hutchinson sign, but not the longitudinal brushy pigmentation, more irregular, either parallel ridge, which you see somewhat frequently in periungual melanomas, or sometimes periungual parallel furrow pattern in association with something gnarly and disgusting looking. And then F is familial, so personal or family history of dysplastic nevus syndrome and melanoma. So that is the ABCDEFs of longitudinal melanonychia from another lovely article.
Yes, that was from an article by Levitt in 2000. Mm-hmm. But the article that we discussed in demo episode number 3 by Shari Lipner et al. Came out in 2019, said that we should reconsider all of those based mostly on dermoscopy and how it's been changing how we feel about these things over the, you know, intervening 19 years since that was proposed. So even in adults, we can't figure it out, though I think it's a little easier in adults. Most of us have a lower threshold to actually just pull the trigger and biopsy in adults and stuff like that. So it's hard, and I'm sorry. That's what it's just hard. So if you're somebody who's looking for a great project, well, I don't know if we've got enough specimens and so on to make this a great project. But I would love it if there was some budding scientists out there who could figure this out, because it's tough, especially when you've got your patient in front of you. Anything else you want to add?
No, that's good.
All right. All right, friends, thanks for joining us today. So today we had Jules Lipoff on the show to discuss the importance of creativity in medicine, among some other things. And then we talked your ear off about longitudinal melanonychia. I promise we won't do it again, at least for a while, maybe if something else comes up. And thanks, of course, to our institutions. Thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle, and thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. Thanks to Morgan Dykeman, medical student and member of Team Dermosphere, who keeps our social media accounts moving along. Yes, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also find us on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which also has links to all of the original articles and is a good way to get in touch with us as well. And if you really like hearing our voices, you can listen to us on our other podcast.
We have another podcast called Skincast. This is directed towards the lay public. It's a shorter podcast. Each episode's only about 15 to 20 minutes. And usually we cover a single topic in each one, such as how to use sunscreen to protect your skin, acne and its treatment, taking care of warts. We've even had specialized episodes on things like face paints for Halloween and allergic contact dermatitis. So if you're looking for a resource for patients to learn more about their individual conditions, that's a great place to send them. It's also a nice place for people who are lay people that just want to learn a little bit more about their skin.
We'd love to see you over there as well, and we'd love to see you in 2 weeks. See you then.